September 30th.
And Formula Nissan consistently ranks as the top Nissan dealer in customer satisfaction in Vermont. So why let just anyone install your tires? Get the best tires installed by the best technicians.
Save more during our winter tire sales drive. The best tires installed at a great price by the best technicians in the business. No appointment necessary, just stop in. We're on the Barry Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut, or visit us at FormulaNissan.com. You'll love the service, you'll love the savings, and you'll love how easy it is to do business here.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Nice day out there today. Little last taste of fall or maybe even summer. No, that would be pushing a little bit. Thanks for joining us on the program today. It is Veterans Day. Want to begin with thanking all of you that have served this country, that have made it possible for people like me to be doing what I'm doing today. Thank you. Coming up on the program today, in just a moment here, we're going to talk with retired Navy SEAL Bill Atkinson. One of the things we're going to talk with Bill about, this recent controversy involving another Navy SEAL who has written a book about the Osama bin Laden raid. This was the second Navy SEAL involved in that. We're also going to talk a little bit about what's going on with Navy SEALs. And later in the program, too, I'd like to get some of your input on the new head of the Veterans Administration, Robert McDonald, the one-time head of Procter & Gamble, a really interesting choice by President Obama to clean up some of the messes at the Veterans Administration, in particular at the hospitals where there have been waiting lines, and then there was just this massive cover-up to try to cover up that problem. So we'll chat about that as well. Also coming up in our second hour this morning, we're going to chat with Julie Tesler, who's involved in an organization that's trying to combine some services for those who suffer from mental illnesses. So that'll be coming your way at about 10:15 this morning. We would love to hear from you. Your phone call is an important part of the program. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Let's give a nice home radio Vermont welcome this morning to Bill Atkinson. Bill lives in Burlington and is a retired Navy SEAL. Thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm well, Mark. Thanks for the invite. It's great to be here this morning.
Yeah, a very interesting story.
Thank you.
I guess maybe the best way to frame this is, how did you even get into the Navy SEALs?
Purely by accident. I never even heard of Navy SEALs. In the 70s, I was living here in Vermont, decided that I would join the Navy. My dad had been in the Navy. One of my brothers was looking to go into the Navy. So I decided to join the Navy to learn a trade, signed up for and was guaranteed school for hull technician, a ship fitter, essentially. In boot camp, I was introduced to some puffy-chested guys in tight T-shirts. They were SEALs. They showed a really cool film. I was impressed by that. And I thought, geez, I'd like to see if I could do that. So I took a screening test about a week later. I passed that. The puffy-chested guys in a tight T-shirt said, congratulations, you passed that. You also passed additional screening. Upon completion of your hull technician school in Philadelphia, you'll have orders to go to SEAL training, or BUDS as they call it, in Coronado, California. Didn't think a whole lot about that. Went to my hull technician school in Philadelphia, and about a week before I was graduating, I got directed to the personnel office where someone said, you know, you have orders to go to BUDS. And I said, oh, well, I guess I'm going. And the rest was history. So purely by accident, when I got out there initially, I thought I was overwhelmed. But as I got into the training, recognized that I really loved it, loved the challenges, and the rest was history. I ended up doing that for a career.
What did you love about it?
The daily challenges, doing something different all the time. I've always loved the water. I enjoyed the challenges presented in SEAL training and as being a SEAL that were in, on, and under the water.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any experience before that?
With waterborne type stuff?
Yeah.
Not really. Comfortable in the water. Took swim lessons as a kid. But Not really. No, but I wasn't dive certified or...
Had you done any scuba stuff?
No scuba stuff.
Wow. That was your first introduction to scuba.
It was indeed, and it's quite an introduction when you're going through SEAL training. They really test your mettle early on when you get into that portion of the training.
Is it like Officer and a Gentleman where they dump you in that like a space capsule goes down in the water and you got to figure out which way's up and all that kind of stuff?
I don't want to say more challenging than that because that's certainly challenging, but you are your own little capsule when they put you at the bottom of a pool and you've got scuba gear on. You have to follow very specific instructions while one or two instructors are over you, making your life miserable, discombobulating you, and challenging you to stay calm, cool, and collected while you perform the very specific procedures to regain the scuba that you had that they took off of you.
Wow.
And make it work again.
Wow. Of course, you also wonder if Deborah Winger showed up during the training, too. 244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. So go back here. What year did you actually join?
Joined the Navy in 1977, and actually went to SEAL training started SEAL training in January of 78, and I did that for, did the Navy for 21 years.
What was the screening they did with you initially? What were they looking for in that?
Well, there's the physical screen test, which even today is still the baseline metric that the Navy uses and special warfare and special operations use to assess one's viability to pursue one of these programs, including SEAL. In addition to that, they do mental screening, moral screening, and that involves simple things like the entrance exam to get into the service. Are your scores adequate across the board? And then what's your background like?
What do they do for mental training, or to test your mental training? What do they do on that?
Up front, there's not a whole lot. As time goes by, and when you get into the training, there's considerable. But the mental piece, it's really pretty basic.
Okay.
It's a series of questions that they may or may not ask you, but oftentimes it's those sorts of things are handled by recruiters, even back here, before one goes forward into the service. Those questions are already answered, generally speaking, for the individuals that screen you for special operations jobs.
Do you remember any of those questions?
I don't.
Well, obviously you passed them, but, huh?
Right.
What about the physical screening, the initial one? What was that all about? What were they looking for in that?
The physical screen test actually has not changed. The standards have gotten a little more challenging, but the screen test itself is still the same thing. And that's a 500-yard swim followed by calisthenics of push-ups, sit-ups, and pull-ups, followed by a mile-and-a-half timed run. So that may not sound like much.
It sounds easy, Bill.
It looks easy, and it sounds easy, but actually doing that physical screen test all together at one time is challenging for most individuals.
How come? What's the part of it that's really tough?
Usually by the time individuals get to the run portion, they're pretty tired.
Mm-hmm.
And the standards to be competitive these days to earn a contract are pretty darn tough. The individuals that take the test today actually go into a national draft system, unlike in the past. So it's much more competitive. Candidates are much more scrutinized, even with a physical screen test. The standards of the screen test, is still the same, but the standards are more challenging with respect to the jobs, in particular SEAL. Mm-hmm. Somebody wants to be a SEAL today, they've really got to knock that physical screen test out of the park to be competitive.
What is the job of a SEAL?
To conduct direct action operations, reconnaissance missions, counterintelligence, personal security, unconventional warfare in all sorts of environments. SEALs historically have been the water guys, and they still are. If there's missions, special operations missions that have to be conducted in, on, or under the water, the SEALs, generally speaking, are going to get the nod first. But, of course, as we all know, over the past several years, a lot of their special operations have been conducted over land.
Right, right, including the bin Laden one.
Including the bin Laden one. And, of course, that's because a lot of the conflicts that exist today are overland. There's not a whole lot that's been going on that we're aware of, anyway, in, on, and under the water.
Mm-hmm. Is it all right to talk about how many SEALs there are currently?
That's a great question. I should have the answer for that, especially with the current job I have. I'm going to hazard a guess and say it's over 2,000. And I don't know exactly what the mix of officer and enlisted is. But there was a great need back in 2005, 2006 to increase the enlisted force to over 1,500. I think that's been achieved at this point. It may be closer to 2,000 just for the enlisted force. But I think the SEAL community in its entirety, officer enlisted, is over 2,000 now, which on a scale, even in special operations, is still fairly small when compared to Army special operations.
And what would you guess, how many people are trying to seek those 2,000 jobs? I mean, what's the application to acceptance factor? Like 10 to 1, 50 to 1?
Well, I can actually talk about my current job, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, totally.
I'm a mentor for men and women that want to join the Navy to pursue special operations jobs, including SEAL. Work for Navy Recruiting District New England. That district's jurisdiction is all the New England states and upstate New York. And so, as you might imagine, 9 out of 10 guys that come see me today want to be SEAL. Go figure. But the selection process, both with a physical screen test and with the screening that I do, both myself and the mentor team that I work with, I would say on average, out of those 10 guys that come to me today that want to be SEAL, probably 3 to 4 really have, in my estimation, the right stuff to be SEALs. Here's another interesting point related to all this, Mark. Back when I went through SEAL training, and even prior to me going through SEAL training, on average, on the enlisted side for SEAL applicants that would show up out at Buds in Coronado to go through SEAL training, for every 10 guys, 3, on the enlisted side, 3 guys would make it through. The baseline applicant that Buds receives today is better than it's ever been. The guys that are getting out there are better than they've ever been. The success rate hasn't changed.
Mm. Wow.
Still 3 out of 10.
Wow. How do you explain that?
It's the mental piece.
Okay.
Tolerance for adversity, mental toughness, being able to embrace the SU blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
Because going through SEAL training is all about that. It's tolerance for adversity, which the method to that madness, of course, is what these men have to be able to do in all kinds of situations and conditions.
Did you read Unbroken by Laura Hildenbrand by any chance about the World War II guy?
I did read that. What was that gentleman's name? The guy that broke he didn't break the 4-minute mile, but he was a heck of a runner as well.
Yeah, Louis Zamperini.
Zamperini. I sure did. What a great book.
Because I'm thinking of tolerance to adversity. Let's not talk about the book because we don't want to blow it for anybody. It is one of the best books out there.
Tremendous book.
But so what I'm interested in, you at one point you were doing survival training.
I did. I worked for the Navy Survival School for 3 years, based out of Brunswick, Maine. They've got several thousand acres in the western region of Maine, and I worked there as a field force instructor, and then I also worked in another portion of the schoolhouse for about 6 months.
We're talking with Bill Atkinson. Bill is a retired Navy SEAL. If you want to join our conversation, you can at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Can you tell me a little bit about what that training involves? Because this is what people that get trained who are pilots, for example, so if you go down, what you're supposed to do, all of this survival stuff. So what do you teach people in this school?
I think the basic premise of that school today still remains to teach all attendees code of conduct of the U.S. Of the U.S. fighting force, military personnel, men and women. So it's a code of conduct by which they should live by and conduct themselves. But it's also equally important with that school is, hey, if you actually are captured by the, quote, enemy, how should you conduct yourself? What sort of things can you do to the best of your ability to survive that period of time that you're in the hands of the enemy? Mm-hmm. What sort of things can you do? And so there's an emphasis on that in the schoolhouse as well, but a great emphasis on code of conduct. What? How do you conduct yourself as a military person?
Okay. And what's the message that you're given in that training?
Essentially, it's about honor, courage, and commitment. And no matter what the conditions are, no matter how bad they are, is to continue to conduct yourself with honor, courage, and commitment, even in the force of in a situation that's completely miserable.
Mm-hmm. But are you allowed to talk at some point? I mean, even Zamperini and those guys all at one point were talking. I mean, they were getting, you know, things shoved under their fingernails, all of that kind of stuff.
It's an individual choice. And what I mean by that is how much is one willing to put up with and tolerate and be able to tolerate before one actually divulges information, whether that information is accurate or not,
mm-hmm.
Is up to the ability of that individual and how clever they can be or not. And again, that's a very good question, Mark, because it would be almost impossible to quantify or qualify how a person would react or conduct themselves in that situation where their mettle's being tested, they're being tortured or whatever is actually happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great question. But I will just say this, that the schoolhouse does conduct training that teaches individuals gives them some tips and tricks on, geez, if the bad guys that to which you're a captive start doing things to you that really put you in a very uncomfortable place, and you're finding it hard to conduct yourself according to the code of conduct, what do you do next? Well, here's some things to think about.
Mm-hmm. Is there actual training where you get some of the techniques that you might anticipate, and does that better prepare you? I mean, if I put sticks under your fingernails, is it going to make it easier for you in training? Is it going to make it easier for you out in the real world if that happens?
Well, it depends on the sticks, the type of sticks.
Okay,
just kidding. No, the Navy
super
and actually
sharp ones.
The Navy and all the services have a school that and part of the curriculum of that school is to actually gain all the attendees, all the students' exposure to situations where they have to use some of those tips and tricks, and then provide coaching, real time coaching, direct and immediate feedback on how they're doing with that.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, you were involved in a couple of pretty serious operations, Operation Urgent Fury, that was the one that was in Grenada in 1983, when Reagan was in office, and Operation Uphold Democracy in 1994. Pretty good spread on those dates, 1994 and 1983.
Absolutely, a pretty good spread. Back when I was on active duty, quite frankly, Mark, there wasn't a whole lot going on. So Operation Urgent Fury was down in Grenada, as you said, in the Caribbean. I was on a deployment. We had just started the deployment. It was a shipboard deployment with Marines. And we were supposed to head across to the Mediterranean. But we all noticed as the days passed after we picked up the Marines in North Carolina, that the sun was rising off the left or port side of the ship. The water was changing color, and it was getting more warm and humid. And so...
You said, we're not going to the Mediterranean. We're not in Kansas anymore. We're not going to the Mediterranean.
Right, exactly. Where are we headed? It would appear we're headed south, and sure enough, we were. 3 to 4 days prior to our arrival off the coast of Grenada, we got word that there were problems down there. There were problems with Grenada itself. There may have been some issues with the Cubans at the time, who we were not in the best of relationship with. There may have been other countries involved and well, but most importantly, we had some Americans down there, including
medical
students at the university down there, and we were concerned for their safety and welfare. So anyway, one thing led to another, and I was in a SEAL platoon. We conducted what are called advanced force operations for the Marines who were going to go ashore. So we did reconnaissance and surveillance work, and that was all over water. And the first mission we conducted was close to the shore. It was on the shoreline, actually, and the second one was slightly inland, but not too much.
Were you ever in any danger? I guess that's relative, right?
Well, right. It's relative. It's interestingly, the first mission we conducted, which was what's called a combat hydrographic reconnaissance mission, where we had to check out a stretch of beach for the Marines to land on. The weather and surf conditions were extremely marginal, and the visibility was terrible. A couple of us, myself included, had to go ashore before anybody else went ashore to check out the stretch of beach that we were going to be working along. And because of the conditions, including the visibility, quite frankly, I had could not tell neither myself nor my swim buddy if that was driftwood on shore or if there were people in the prone position waiting for us to come ashore. So that was probably the most hair-raising portion of that mission and the missions that we conducted while there.
Okay. Let me guess. It was driftwood, right?
It was driftwood.
Wow.
Thank goodness.
Wow.
At least I think it was.
So how long were you there? Do you remember?
In Grenada, or you
yeah.
mean that specific
yeah.
mission? We were in Grenada for less than a week. While we were there, you may recall a very significant terrorist attack occurred in Beirut, Lebanon.
That's right.
While we were there. That was right around Halloween of 1983, where a truck bomb detonated and killed 243 Marines and a couple of Navy guys over in Beirut. So as soon as we finished up operations in Grenada, we got underway and steamed across the Atlantic, right through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Mediterranean, all the way down to the far east, far end of the Mediterranean to be off the coast of Lebanon.
Wow. That was, you know, what you thought your original destination was. How ironic.
That's right.
Talk about your work in Haiti. What happened there?
More reconnaissance and surveillance work. The again, there was a decision made that we would have to U.S. forces would go ashore, but of course the SEALs once again were an advanced force package, doing reconnaissance and surveillance work in preparation for large scale operations ashore, which never actually took place. You may recall that I think that it may have been former President Jimmy Carter. It may have been him. I don't recall who it was, but I believe it was him. We're able to negotiate terms to calm things down so that we didn't do a full-on invasion of Haiti. But reconnaissance and surveillance work, again, from sea to shore, along the shoreline, that was the extent of the work that we did.
Same weather problems, or was it an easier journey on that one?
That's a great question. The conditions actually were terrific. For the conduct of that mission, if we weren't trying to be low key and not seen, invisible, so to speak, which is one of the things that reconnaissance or surveillance people, you don't want people to know you're there. And with the mission that we conducted, one of the missions we conducted there, there was no sea state. We were in a large bay. The water was like glass, and we had a full moon with very little cloud cover. So
wow.
Not the best of conditions.
Wow. Put a spotlight on yourself.
Exactly.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll come back, continue our discussion. We've been talking this morning with retired Navy SEAL Bill Atkinson. We'll talk a little bit about the Osama bin Laden controversy coming up after we take a short break. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
802 Honda promised super friendly service with low pricing, and you heard us. Thanks to all of our customers for making 802 Honda the fastest growing Honda dealer in Vermont.
At 802 Honda, we love to listen. Our Lease It Your Way program is designed to customize a lease for both your budget and driving needs.
You can drive away every new Honda with absolutely no money down, or pick your payment, and we will show exactly how much money down you need. The biggest myth about leasing is mileage. We're custom designing leases for higher mileage drivers all the time, often with 20,000 miles or more. Let us custom tailor a lease your way.
Find out what many of your neighbors already know. 802 Honda is the only place to get your next Honda. We also have the top-ranked service department in Vermont.
Click on 802honda.com. Call 223-9700. Drive I-89 to exit 7. We're less than 1 minute off the interstate. 802 Honda, driving to be Vermont's number one Honda dealer.
This holiday season, you can collect and win cash and other great prizes with the new Holiday Collect and Win from the Vermont Lottery. Use your smartphone to download the free Collect and Win app or go online. From now till December 13th, when you play qualifying draw games like Powerball, Megabucks, and others, you can scan the ticket or enter online to collect game symbols. Collect 6 game symbols on one card and you're entered for a chance to win over $50,000 in prizes. Go to VTLottery.com for more Collect and Win details. Please play responsibly.
Cleveland Cedar Products in Wolcott has an end-of-season closeout price on half-by-six Red Cedar B-grade clapboards. Limited quantity of 20,000 lineal feet. Don't miss this incredible price on Red Cedar clapboards from Cleveland Cedar Products. Better yet, have Cleveland's do quality pre-staining with primer or natural stains. If it's quality siding and a great price, it must be Cleveland Cedar Products, Route 15, 3 miles west of Wolcott Village. See them at cedarguy.com or call Henry at 888-5393.
At Mooresville's newest store, Mattress Sofa Warehouse, you'll find Lazy Boy recliners, Simmons Beauty Rest bedding, Tempur-Pedic, coaster, and much more. At Mattress Sofa Warehouse, they have recliners starting at just $279 and queen mattress sets starting at just $299. Mattress Sofa Warehouse offers every day fair pricing and every day no interest payment options. Every day. Stop in at the brand new Mattress Sofa Warehouse, Gallery Lane, off the brand new Route 100, Mooresville Bypass. MattressSofaWarehouse.com.
$3,000. That's the minimum your trade is worth during Cash for Junkers. No matter what it is or how little you might think it's worth. Hi, this is Steve Sace from the new McMahon Chevy Buick in Mooresville.
And I'm Ed Dever, sales manager at McMahon. During Cash for Junkers, if your trade rolls, floats, or flies and has a VIN number, you get a guaranteed minimum trade allowance of $3,000 toward any used vehicle we have in stock. We take almost anything in on trade. Trucks, sleds, planes, skidders.
Skidders, huh? Well, why not? If you get your skidder here, we'll take it. We'll take just about anything else. With Cash for Junkers, you'll get a trade allowance of at least $3,000 towards any used car, truck, and odd-two lots. And if your trade's worth more, you'll get more. Come see us today or check our used inventory out online at McMahonChevrolet.com.
The new McMahon and McMahon's Import Corner, where we always have a great selection of late model imports. At the corner of Route 15 and Route 100 in Mooresville, now is the time to get out of that old beater and into something more reliable.
Cash for Junkers, only at McMahon and McMahon's Import Corner. We make deals the other guys won't. Chevy, find new roads.
Back, continue our discussion. We've been talking this morning with retired Navy SEAL Bill Atkinson. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's talk a little bit about this Osama bin Laden controversy. As you know, Bill, many of our listeners do too, there have been now two former Navy SEALs who have written books about the Osama bin Laden raid, which happened right in 2011. There's a fairly recent one that happened, and then there was one 2 years ago. In both cases, the question, I guess it's not even a question, but the problem has been that these seals violated the contract that you guys sign, and which doesn't allow you to do this. So what does the contract actually allow or not allow you to do?
Can I first say something?
You can.
Preceding that?
Yes.
The books that they wrote, Right, Wrong, Good, Bad, or Indifferent, it's a reflection of who we all are, and it's a reflection of society. What do I mean by that? So these guys wrote books. There's a lot of controversy around the fact that they wrote those books. But if one were to Google Navy SEAL books, one would discover that there have been books written for many, many, many years, even preceding Vietnam-era days, by SEALs about SEALs conducting SEAL missions. So I'm not defending what these gentlemen did. I'm simply stating it's reality. The last job I had in the Navy, in the SEAL teams, I was a what's called a command master chief. Some may be more familiar with the term sergeant major. That's an Army term. I was a command master chief of a SEAL team. So I co-managed a SEAL team with the commanding officer, about 230 people, 150 of them being SEAL operators. And the kind of things that I and the commanding officer had to deal with on a daily basis, personnel and personal issues-wise, were a reflection of our society. That's just the way it is, and it's still that way today. So with
I'm not
these,
sure I understand what you mean by that. What do you mean by that?
The basic conversation that I would have with my commanding officer when we had situations come up with individuals that we had to deal with, I referred to them as civil affairs because they occurred outside the SEAL team and outside the special warfare community. I would say, you know, Skipper, we've got a lot of great guys here. They're SEALs. They're very capable guys, but they're still human.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still going to do things that are not okay. And we've got to deal with that. He had, in my opinion, he had a little bit of a struggle with that. And he would say, well, no, we're SEALs. We're different that way, and we're better than that. And as a whole, in the SEAL community, that's absolutely true. SEALs are the quiet professionals. They're fairly humble guys. They're very unassuming. If you met a SEAL on the street, you may not realize he's a SEAL. There isn't the bravado and all the sorts of things that one might imagine there is, but as a whole, there isn't. So in the case of these guys that wrote the books, in the case of some of the situations that we had to deal with, I simply look at it as it's a reflection of society, it's a reflection of humans, and whatever motivates them to do the things they do, including write books like this, right, wrong, good, bad, or indifferent, it's just what happens. And so in the case of these books, I don't read any of them. I become aware of them when they become public information and news. I do think it's unfortunate that people make the decisions to write these books. I think in the case of these two individuals, I don't want to make any assumptions. But based on what I've read, I would say in terms of the Matt Bissonnette, who wrote the No Easy Day, it's a little bit surprising what I've read, that he was unaware of some of the consequences that occurred, and so he's very unhappy about that. And I believe he's suing his attorneys.
Yeah, he's suing his lawyers for not giving him the right information before he wrote the book. That they've now the government is collecting the proceeds of the book, and he says he's out $8 million.
Well, I'm not sure what that means when he says he's out $8 million, because he certainly doesn't make that kind of money as a SEAL, and I don't know if he's even a SEAL anymore.
From the book.
From the book. But the as a SEAL, we have to pay so much attention to detail in everything we do. I think it's unfortunate in the case of Matt Bissonnette that perhaps some of that attention to detail did not carry over into his decision to make to write a story, to publish a book, and to release the book. That's when I read the accounts of what's happened here, it's the first thing that comes to my mind is, I wonder if Matt was really paying attention to the details of the decision he made to write the book, and then as he moved forward, continued to pay attention to the details of what he was doing. And I would say that's debatable.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by attention to details.
Well, first of all, it appears that he made a decision to write the book without talking to some of the people that he should have talked to, including the SEAL community and the higher-ups in the SEAL community. And then when he wrote the book, that potentially was a miscalculation on his part. But then once he wrote the book, in terms of making decisions to release the book, I would question whether he really paid attention to what consequences might occur with that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm really answering your question or not.
Let me try this.
Okay.
So what you mentioned, the Navy SEALs have written books in the past.
They have.
So what are you allowed to write about, and what are you not allowed to write about?
Certainly. If you're going to write about anything, it would have to be in a fairly general terms. Anything that's classified information, you absolutely cannot write about. But bigger picture, to step outside that box, and this is Bill talking, I would really not want to write a book about my career or my life as a SEAL. I would be more interested in writing things about leadership and management as it relates to my experiences as a SEAL, tolerance for adversity and mental toughness as it relates to my experiences as a SEAL. But I would not be interested, for example, in writing a book about any missions I conducted in Grenada, any missions I conducted in Haiti, or any training and operations I conducted anywhere else that were high risk or really cool. I would have no desire to do that whatsoever. That's the quiet professional in me.
Mm-hmm.
I take pride in what I do. I'm proud of the fact that I was a career SEAL. I love what I do as a mentor, training men and women that want to pursue Navy Special Operations jobs. But to actually get into the nitty-gritty of missions I conducted, I have no desire to do that. That's the quiet professional in me, and there's no desire in me to do that sort of thing. And I really wonder what compels people to do this sort of thing. In the case of Matt Bissonnette, I don't know him. I've never met him. I'm sure he's a great guy. He was probably a great SEAL. You have to be a great SEAL to be at SEAL Team 6. But I really question why he made the decision to write the book. I question why he and others have made the decision to go public about missions that they conducted as SEALs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why somebody would do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you can guess some of the motivations that might drive somebody to do that. Ego, money, a little bit of fame. But that's not something, fame is something that it sounds like most SEALs really avoid.
Most SEALs do avoid that.
This bothers you, these guys wrote this book, that they're bragging? Do you consider it bragging?
Well, I don't know if they're bragging, because I don't read the books. People give me books about SEALs, and I don't read them. Mm-hmm. I had a career as a SEAL. I loved what I did. But when there's books that come out written by SEALs or written about SEALs, the only time that I would take into consideration reading any of those books is if I were to suggest those books to some of the applicants I'm working with today to help them have a better understanding of the jobs, including SEAL, special operations jobs, including SEAL. And if there was a message in there that would be to their benefit, preparing them for the path they're going to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's ego, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I suppose it could be, but I don't want to make that assumption. Another book that comes to mind is American Sniper. And that book was given to me. I haven't read it. I think it's very unfortunate, and I don't want to try to tie a thread, but the gentleman that wrote that book is not alive today. Now, if he had not written that book, would he still be alive? Who knows? Mm-hmm. What motivated the individual to take that guy's life? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But why did he write the book?
Mm-hmm.
Why does he need to publicize the fact that he was a sniper, that he was a SEAL, that he was a sniper, and that he killed a lot of people?
But on the Osama bin Laden raid, what's wrong with us back home here finding out the nitty-gritty details of what happened on this?
Why is there a need to know?
Curiosity.
How deep does that curiosity go? It's the fact that we found and got Osama bin Laden, I think, is significant. I think it's put to rest and created peace for a lot of people that suffered the consequences of things that Osama bin Laden and his terrorist organization did around the world for a number of years. But in terms of the actual, well, how did we get this guy? What were the details of how we got this guy? I did see the movie. The movie's a great, it's actually a very exciting movie. It's a great, it's an interesting movie to watch, or it was for me. But in terms of the very specific details that might be outlined in Matt Bissonnette's book, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
I would say that's too much.
Mm-hmm.
Suffice to say that the SEALs conducted a mission to capture or kill bin Laden, and they were successful. I think that's good enough.
244-1777, our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. A moment of your time for our friends at Jet Service Envelope. If you're looking for an outstanding local printer, make it our friends at the Jet. You'll find them in South Barrie. And you'll also find them at the end of this phone number, 229-9335, 229-9335. Also on the web at jetservice-envelope.com. I want to go back to this survival training that you've been involved in up in Maine. So can you give me an example or two? Do they have, I mean, do you go out 3 days, a week, month? How does it work?
When I taught at the school, it was the entire school was a little over a week long. And it was education by fire hose. The students would arrive. We'd outfit them with all the clothing and equipment they needed. We'd put them right into academics for the next couple of days. Then we put them out in the field for 2 to 3 days, as I recall. Then we'd put them in an environment that tested their knowledge of what we'd imparted on them the prior few days. And then we'd wrap up the training with a debrief. Both as a debriefing the entire class and then debriefing each individual and giving them a feedback on how they actually did in the schoolhouse. So the schoolhouse is longer now, and I think that's a good idea because they spend more time working with the groups and working with the individuals so that when they leave the school, they're better equipped with better knowledge and retention of that knowledge to take it forward with them out into the field and to put, hopefully, to remember to put to use if they find themselves in a situation where they have to use it. The vast majority of the individuals that go through that SEER training, as it's called, survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, are considered high risk of capture category personnel.
Mm-hmm. What's the hardest part of it that week?
Probably the resistance training, where every individual has the opportunity to be put into situations where there are other individuals trying to get information from them. What's your job? What do you do? What sort of equipment do you use? Who do you use that equipment with? Where do you train and operate? How do you train and operate? And that individual's ability to first not answer any of those questions, and then second, if they're unable to do that, how do they answer those questions? And hopefully they answer those questions in a way that provides very little to no useful information to the individuals asking those questions.
And then, sounds like some of the answers I get on this program.
Yeah.
Huh. Some of those people have obviously been through your training program. 244-1777, our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. I'm sort of having a difficult time getting my head around the word schoolhouse, because I usually think of a schoolhouse as being something like elementary school kids go to, but this is a totally different operation.
It is, in fact, a totally different operation. When so we're still on the Sears School
yes.
piece. Initially, it is a schoolhouse or a classroom environment. But then, as you might imagine, that classroom environment evolves over the course of the training into field training out in the field, teaching basic survival and evasion skills, and then still out in the field where there's the opportunity for the group and individuals within the group to practice resistance to the attempt by individuals to gain information. And then, of course, the last part, escape, is part of the schoolhouse field training out in the field. There may or may not be the opportunity to try to practice escaping from individuals that are trying to put you in a captive situation, captivity situation.
Did you ever practice anything closely resembling waterboarding?
What's that?
I don't really know.
No, we did not. We did not do that.
Okay. All right. Give me an example of an evasion skill.
A simple evasion skill would be to...
away from people, not a question.
Right, away from people. Would be to develop the basic skills of using natural cover and concealment to hide oneself or to move either during the hours of daylight or the hours of darkness in a way that one would be difficult to be detected.
Okay.
So, and that would be that the Navy SEER school does a very good job of teaching those skills. And that schoolhouse, as I mentioned, which is in Maine, they run their training year-round. So they provide opportunity to teach those skills in all four seasons.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you mentor potential SEALs.
Yes.
Is that a fair way to describe it?
It sure okay. is.
So when people come to you and they say they're interested in doing this, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask you, because I would be the quickest washout in the history of this program. So what questions do you ask them to sort of try to get a feel for whether or not they have that right stuff?
For SEALs specifically, I'm very direct. Why do you want to be a SEAL? What do SEALs do? Do you know any SEALs? What kind of missions do SEALs conduct? What's your background educationally? What are your interests? What are your hobbies? What do you do for physical activity? How often do you do it? How comfortable are you in the water? Do you like the water? How much time do you spend in the water? Or if you had free time, would it be around the water? Do you really like the water environment? Because SEALs, even with all the missions they conduct these days, so many of them overland, they're not... They don't involve the water. SEALs still are the water guys, and you absolutely have to like the water to be a good SEAL.
Mm-hmm. Do you still scuba dive?
I haven't done it in years. I miss it. I had the opportunity with the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum as part of their Maritime Research Institute to be on their dive team for a couple of years. That was very enjoyable. Did a number of dives in Lake Champlain, including Valcour Bay. But I haven't done any diving, including recreational, for a number of years now.
Uh-huh.
But that's something I really miss that. Whole different world. Have you ever done any scuba diving?
No, I haven't.
It's a wonderful, the water is a wonderful environment. I would have to say some of my favorite places that I have done some diving are in subtropical waters. Mm. So much to see. It's just a whole different world.
Well, after you walk me through survival school, we can do that some afternoon as a celebration. I mean,
sure.
I want to talk about what you did post-retirement. What year did you retire?
I retired in 98.
You, shortly after you retired, sold your house, put your possessions in storage, and did what?
Hiked the Appalachian Trail, or the Appalachian Trail, for 9 weeks.
Why?
Always had an interest in doing that. My goal was to get to the, quote, halfway point, which isn't actually the halfway point, but was to get to Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. And just wanted to have that experience. I think I had talked to a couple individuals that hiked some or all of the trail, and I was intrigued by the fact that there is a trail in that part of the country, the United States, that goes close to or through some really densely populated areas. How could a trail like that be pristine and be preserved and provide an opportunity to do some hiking that would be enjoyable? And it was every bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my motivation for doing that. Again, I had hoped to get up to Harper's Ferry, only made it into Virginia, but spent 9 weeks and had a real good taste of what the trail was like, and it was absolutely worth it. And it's a wonderful trail. So happy that we have it, and it's well preserved and protected.
Were you by yourself most of the time?
About half of it.
Okay. What was that like? What was that like just being with yourself for that long a period of time? Did you get anything out of it?
I did. And quite honestly, you're even if you're on the trail by yourself, you're really not by yourself. There's shelters about every 10 to 15 miles. And so you frequently see the same people on a daily basis, or you catch up with them at the end of the day in a shelter. So even though you may spend fairly significant portions of time hiking by yourself, you're never really by yourself mm-hmm. on the trail. But the part of that I did enjoy was, for me, it was decompressing from being in the Navy for 21 years and being a career SEAL for most of that. And decompressing from the last job that I had in the Navy as a command master chief of a SEAL team.
Did it work?
It did. Absolutely did work. And the simplicity of life on the trail was wonderful.
Boy, I bet you had an easier time than a lot of people out on the trail.
I don't know if I did. It was actually a very one of the most valuable learning experiences of that was when I first got on the trail, I had about a 60-pound pack. I didn't have hiking sticks. I had on really heavy boots.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly learned in probably about 2 weeks that my pack had too much weight in it, had much more stuff in there than I didn't need, and that I didn't need the heavy-duty hiking boots I had. And the hiking sticks were extremely useful on the trail, in particular going down slope. And so I learned a lot of valuable things very quickly with that.
Well, I'll tell you, that was a fun hour for me. I hope it was half as fun for you.
It's over already?
We're class is dismissed here at the schoolhouse. nothing under the fingernails. Thank you for coming in, Bill. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Former Navy SEAL Bill Atkinson. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugarbush and the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is next.
AP Radio News.